Okay, welcome everyone. So we're very pleased today to have Alexander Myberg, who is joining us from UCSB. He's a PhD candidate working with Bella Bauer and has made some very impressive contributions, including the work relating to the complexity of approximating the permanent of positive semi-definite matrices. And today will tell us about quantum constraint problems and their complexity. Alex, please go ahead.
Thank you. All right, yeah. So this will be about a result that quantum constraint problems can be complete. So naturally at this complexity level for BQP, QCMA, and BPP with some asterisks there about BPP. So to explain the background for this problem a little bit and what led me to it, first, I'll talk briefly about classical constraint problems and what is known there, which has some neat facts. Then how this looks in the quantum setting, what we already know, and then what is the problem? And then how this proof actually goes, how we show that this what the actual new results are. And then I'll talk about future work. So classically a constraint problem is given by I have variables that are allowed to take some finite set of values, some relationships between a fixed number of them, so not arbitrarily large relationships. So like saying, okay, if I have Boolean variables saying that this one is true or that one is false, or here are five variables colored red, green, or blue, and I say exactly three of these are red. And so I have some kind of constraints between small sets of these variables, and they're saying things about their values. And the problem is there some assignment to all these variables that obeys all these constraints? So this is easy. I can, follow these like some sort of chain of implications and quickly find an answer or show that there is none. And sometimes it's very hard, and it's NP hard. Three set being the classic example. There's a natural view of this as an energy kind of problem, like in a physical sense, where you say that I've got some penalty if I violate the rule, and zero energy if it's obeyed. And then I can write down some overall local Hamiltonian, and I say, is there a zero energy state, which means I was saying, is there a frustration in the system? The interesting result that I want to talk about briefly is in the classical setting, people realized that basically every problem they looked at was either NP, so it was efficiently solvable, or it was as hard as possible, it was NP complete. So if you look at there are plenty of problems that we care about, like factoring integers or graph isomorphism, that are probably not NP and probably not NP complete, but they don't have any obvious form as a constraint problem. Like I can write down integer factorization, I can encode it into an instance of 3-sat, but then that 3-sat problem in general can also be much harder. There isn't a way to write down some sort of funky version of 3-sat clauses where every problem I make is like factoring. So the only I can put factoring into a NP complete thing, but I can't seem to make any constraint problems that capture exactly the difficulty of factoring. And so this led to what was called the CSP dichotomy conjecture, that no constraint problem is NP intermediate. Nothing is between NP complete and P. And this was proved independently by Zhuk and Bulatov at essentially the exact same time in 2017. And so now it's the CSP dichotomy theorem. So this is a pretty interesting result, that when you have some sets of clauses, some sets of, you could say, interactions that between these classical variables, and I'm allowed to arrange those however I want with any sort of interaction graph, it's checking if there is a violation or not is always either maximally hard or very easy. There's nothing in between. And then there's a natural question of how does this look in the quantum case. And now instead of like true or false, red, green, blue, I've got qubits or qudits. My interactions are local projectors, so I can actually energies of 0 or 1 from some local small set of particles. Add them up into a Hamiltonian. So this could, these are examples of, you know, what an interaction could look like. And I say, yeah, does this have a zero energy ground state? So is it equivalently, is it frustration free, or is this ground state energy above zero? And usually we'd say that we want it to be like gapped above zero. So it's larger than, you know, inverse polynomial in N or something like that. And these are not all in NP, but they are all in QMA. So with a quantum computer, if there is a state, I can, you know, measure all these different projectors repeatedly, and check that they check that they obey all these local projectors that does have zero energy ground state, and I can get pretty high confidence on that. So they're all in QMA. In 2002, it showed that five local Hamiltonians on qubits are universal for QMA, so it's QMA complete. And then this was improved 2013, Bagasa and Nagaj, that quantum three set is QMA complete. So that's a nice analog of the statement that three set is NP complete. And then our quantum two set, on the other hand, has an efficient algorithm for checking frustration. So it's in P. And then any classical problem can be written down as a quantum constraint problem. You can just treat everything, you know, in some common basis. So either quantum problems that are, you know, still in P or NP complete. So there are classes like that. We know that there are QMA complete problems. And in 2008, Bravi and Terhal showed that stochastic Hamiltonians, so if you allow arbitrary six local stochastic interactions, you get a MA complete. So here's stochastic is Hamiltonians with no sign problem. The off diagonal elements are all non-positive. And this is related to like Monte Carlo simulability sort of. And then MA complete is very similar to NP, but when you verify it, so when I'm checking the solution, I use some randomness in my checking. So there is a way, this is a not really a quantum class normally viewed, but they showed that if you take quantum Hamiltonians with this stochastic form with no sign problem, then you get this sort of classical randomized version of NP, which is MA complete. So you can, in this MA, you run many checks and all your checks should work. But unlike the classical case where, you know, everything is in P or is NP complete, there's no reason to expect that this list is complete. Now there, as a fact, there is a classical constraint problem called Hornsat and many others that are P complete. So it isn't just solvable in polynomial time. It captures exactly the power of any polynomial time algorithm. And so it seems like a natural question to me. Is there a quantum problem with a similar property? Is there a quantum constraint problem that we could write down that would capture exactly the power of quantum computer, something that is BQP complete? So that, you know, problem that you can run, solve with a quantum circuit with high correctness efficiently. And so BQP complete means it should be able to capture all of them. There are some well-known BQP complete problems, simple ones being, what is the output of this quantum circuit? There are much more surprising ones like approximate this Jones polynomial from knot theory. So how would this have to look? How would we try to find a constraint problem that captures exactly the difficulty of BQP? It has to be flexible enough to simulate a full quantum computer. We have to be able to encode a circuit somehow in this constraint problem. At the same time, it has to be constrained enough that a quantum computer could somehow like follow through these clauses and systematically check that, you know, this looks like a circuit and check for frustration. So sometimes there can't be any guessing involved. If you think, I would say BQP is most naturally about, you know, quantum circuits. I prescribe a series of operations, you know, over time. And that's quite different from asking for the ground state of a Hamiltonian, asking what is the lowest energy I can possibly achieve. So if BQP is like about time evolution, and here we're sort of asking for an optimization kind of problem. So it's not really immediately clear that this, you know, should be possible. So it turns out that, yes, this is the main result. There is a B2P complete class of Hamiltonian problems, and I'll get to the construction for that shortly. So the precise statement is there is some particular list of five interactions, and you can arrange those however you want on qubits. They're up to, I'll talk some locality. And so you can arrange these on any qubits in whatever interaction in way you want, any without caring about locality. And you can always encode a quantum computer. You can encode any quantum computer you want in this interaction graph. And then there'll be a solution if and only that quantum circuit would output a one. On the other hand, you can arrange these however you like, and there's an efficient algorithm to determine if the resulting system is frustration-free or not. So there's no way to make anything with these things that doesn't look like a quantum circuit in some sense. Or if it doesn't look like a quantum circuit, I can immediately reject. And once this once I got this construction, there were two like pretty immediate, not quite corollaries, but pretty short modifications of this construction to get two more classes. So one was QCMA. So this is problems you can check with a quantum computer, but with just a classical string of bits of advice. So for this, it's like if QMA takes a quantum state in and then runs some circuit to verify it, and NP takes a classical string, runs a classical circuit to verify it. QCMA is taking a classical string, but a quantum verifier. And this requires most of the machinery of BQP because I need to know a lot about where my input is, where the circuit is. But once you have that, it's pretty easy to say, all right, the input has to be classical, but then the circuit evolution is some linear, some unitary evolution that's a regular quantum computation. This is somewhere between BQP and QMA. And the other one is this sort of weird class called CORP. In some cases, I might refer to this as BPP. This is really just what you can do with a randomized classical computer. So there's no input string needed. I'm just running a random classical circuit. And this is pretty easy. You say, I've got my BQP circuit. There's no input. I just run a quantum circuit. Well, now I modify my gate set so that I'm not allowed to have an entanglement. I'm just allowed to, or superpositions, I should say. I'm just using randomness. So once you have BQP, you can reduce this down to a BPP kind of thing. And the reason it's CORP as opposed to BPP has to do with like some of the finer points of like there's only one-sided error here. So I'll never like falsely reject. There's not very many complete problems for CORP. It's not a very commonly talked about class. You can think of it as BPP. CORP is to BPP as QMA1 is to QMA. If you care about QMA1, that will mean something to you. Otherwise, you can think of this as just randomized computation. So the classical difficulty levels are just P and NP, and that's known to be complete. In the quantum case, we have P, NP, MA, and QMA, and we added three more. But this is not known to be exhaustive. So, I mean, it seems like a reasonably complete list. It's hard to imagine what else could fit in this list. But no proof that it is exhaustive. And this is a little picture sort of showing how these things fit together, depending on how many of these acronyms you're unfamiliar with. But I won't spend too long on this. I'll get to the construction, which is, I think, the most, like, this is the meat. So how do we actually prove this? So we need to get a dictionary from circuits to Hamiltonians. So that will require some set of gates that we're allowed to use, and then Kataev's clock construction for showing that five local Hamiltonians are complete. So we'll use that kind of construction to show that, to give us a way to embed any quantum circuit into this Hamiltonian. The harder direction is showing that every Hamiltonian, any interactions that we make, can be described by some sort of circuit. So we either have to be able to analyze it as a circuit, or if it doesn't look like a circuit, then we have to be able to make some other statements, like a way to break it down and analyze pieces or reject it or something like that. So maybe it's not one big circuit. Maybe we have several separate sort of circuits, several different quantum computers, and we'll run each in parallel or in series, whatever. Or maybe we have something that is just totally scrambled, weird looking, but then this will somehow introduce local frustration. So we'll start with Kitaev's QMA complete construction, and then we'll start adding additional sort of structure, specifying additional things about our interactions that will force everything to look nice. So in his construction, some of the qubits we're using as data, as this like a logical zero or a one. Some of the qubits are used to indicate time, so where we are in the time evolution, and then the whole state becomes a history state. It's a superposition over the full computational history. And that's nice. It gives us the ability to build the full, any circuit that we want. The biggest obstacle for us is that circuit can take any input. So that circuit could need some QMA proof. We could need to provide some proof state to this circuit, and then we'll evolve that to get what we want. And we want to prevent that. We want this to be BQP. We want everything to be initialized to zero or something like that. Also, this data and time, they can all be mixed up together. So what if I start operating with unitary on a time qubit? What does that mean? What if my time qubits branch into two separate timelines? I could make configurations that look like this. I want to rule that out. We could have time bits that aren't used for anything or whatever.
Sorry, just to clarify, when you say like could use a time bit as data, you mm-hmm. mean like if you were to take the terms in Kitaev's construction, but then use them in different ways, like other than the
right. So So he has like a pretty simple set of interactions you can use, and that's enough to encode any circuit. But what if I have these interactions? They have some that they're using only as data, some only as time. What if I mix them around? So what if I start using some as data in some clauses and time in others? How am I supposed to interpret that? How am I supposed to rule that out?
Thanks.
So, and the input could be just blank, so it could be anything, or maybe I've got some like weird constraints on it. I want to prevent that case as well. So first what we do is we say data and clock will be two separate states. So I'm going to have, instead of qubits, I'll have four qudits, like as in a four-dimensional qudits. So I'll have a data zero and a data one and a clock zero and a clock one. And then any interaction that uses these, it's going to say, this is a data zero or data one. This is a clock zero. This is a clock one. So if I have one clause that's trying to use a given qudit as a clock and another thing trying to use as a data, those will be in conflict. There'll be immediately be a frustration there. I can't satisfy both those clauses at once. So that's like one way I can start organizing these now. Now every qudit I use is definitely either data or clock. And I want to penalize things that don't look like circuits in terms of how their time is structured. So I can have a sort of pre-processing step that would find these local issues. And then any missing constraints. So if I haven't linked up my time as I should, then the whole circuit should be really trivial to satisfy. So there should be some really simple state where I don't even need really a quantum computer to just say, yeah, because of this thing you forgot to include to make it look like a circuit, it's an easy yes. Like, oh, did you fail to initialize all your qubits to zero? That's going to be some constraint I need to add that all my things start off at zero. Oh, well, if you didn't, then we'll put it in some extra state, an undefined state or something like that. And then this undefined state will magically satisfy every subsequent gate. So if you think of this circuit as taking not just zeros and ones in, but also maybe an undefined U, and this U always makes everything work. All right, well, if I don't initialize all of my qubits to zero, then I can just initialize them to U and everything will work. And I can immediately answer yes without actually needing to do any quantum computation. I'll explain a little bit more here. So in this picture of this is roughly how some things look. So I've got these red regions represent one of these qudits, and these black parts represent some subspaces of them. And then the blue would indicate some interactions. So here I've got this C. This is one pluck qubit, and it's actually an eight-dimensional subspace. So it's got the at the top of this zero C, that's indicating like what time is it? Is it zero or one? That will indicate if we're at that step of the computation or not. Then we'll have two more qubits in this larger qubit, a CB and a CA. And these are qubits that we'll just use to make bell pairs. So I'll make a bell pair between the CA in my first big clock triangle there and the CB in my second big clock triangle. So whenever I have one step of the computation going from time one to time two, part of that interaction will involve requiring this CA subspace and CB subspace next to each other to form a bell pair. Since that pair of qubits forms a bell pair, I've now linked the first clock big qubit and the second big clock qubit together. They can't be linked to anything else. I can't have a bell pair between qubit A and B and also qubit A and C. So now the first clock qubit, that eight-dit there, is definitely followed by the second clock qubit, which is going to be definitely followed by the third one and so on. And if I tried to now have one clock qubit followed by multiple different ones, I would arrive at some frustrations. I can't form multiple bell pairs. So if I try to arrange several clock qubits in a row and then have it branch off, I'll have frustrations. Each one has a definite forerunner and predecessor and successor in this path. And then at the end, I'll have an end clock qubit here. This is this little E. That will also have a special state of its own that I use for indicating a time, and it will also form a bell pair with one of the clock qubits. And that end qubit will be used to initialize one of the as many as I want of the input data qubits to zeros. So I'll have some constraint that, all right, when we're at the very end, when we're just starting time, I'm going to start things off at zero. Yeah, I've got the data qubits here, the clock qubits, which have three qubit subspaces. They've got a qubit for what time it is. I'm making bell pairs to link them together. There's a special sort of end clock space. That end clock space can then be used to set the data qubits to zero. If I don't, I could just set them to an undefined state. These undefined states I will allow to just propagate through the circuit and satisfy everything. So what happens is then, all right, so if I initialize everything to zeros, then I'll have a well-behaved quantum circuit. I could run this on my quantum computer and check that it works. If I didn't initialize any of my bits to zero, then I can just say, all right, well, this is trivially satisfiable. So that's how I avoid this NP or QMA kind of issue where I have some input string I might need to guess to make it work. And this is inspired by some similar things that people have like used for P completeness, where they also have a similar sort of like a ternary logic type idea. So some of the problems that like we have to prevent occurring, like we have to avoid having like, what if the time doesn't end? What if it goes out? And then just one of the clock qubits, is it linked to an endpoint? All right, then they're undefined. What if my clock qubits are linked in a big circle? And you can show that that also ends up being trivially satisfiable. Then, what if I have multiple different timelines acting on the same data? So what if I have several clocked bits here forming a string, they're acting on some data, and then a totally disjoint string of clock qubits acting on that same string. There's each of these strings of clocks has their own notion of time, their own history state they want to form. So what we can do is we can choose a particular universal gate set such that any operation on the qubit, at least the first operation, entangles us with it. So our clocks are always going to be entangled with the data, no matter what. And since we can't have two separate clock strings perfectly entangled with our data, this prohibits this. So we can't have multiple different strings of time acting on the same data. And so that if we see multiple different strings of time acting on the same data, we can say, all right, this has frustration, we can reject. So when all these fixes are accounted for, when we've ruled out all the easy things or all the trivially frustration things, we get this set of interactions that have to look like a circuit, pretty much. And the interactions that we get are 5 local, and they act on 13 qubits, as in 13 dimensional qubits, which is not a great low dimensional space, but you know it's something. And then with some extra work, I showed that any quantum constraint problem can be written purely in terms of qubits, which is not a classically true thing. But we can always reduce to just regular old qubits at the price of locality, so we can need to expand out some more. So then we get 80 local interactions, which is a different thing, not great. But then it's only on qubits. So qubits suffice for this. I'm sure that it could be better. Yeah, and so then QCMA comes pretty easily. So now instead of taking in just zeros, we are allowed to start with zeros or ones, but it has to be a classical state. And so now we say, all right, now this end clause allows it to be a zero or a one, just definitely one or the other, but not both. And then we can make a copy of that in the classical basis, and by copying our whole input data over, essentially forcing a measurement in the Z basis at the start of our computation, we make this input string be classical. And then the RP or really BPP version, we have, it's like BQP, but we're allowed some initial states in a positive 0-1 superposition. So we have some, in addition to our input bits of zero, we have some plus state random bits that are a source of randomness, and then we just run a classical circuit on it. So we just only allow classical gates. So that those two extra classes come about essentially for free. I got some people objecting that this is not very interesting to physicists. This is extremely unnatural of a setting to have a quantum constraint problems that have no notion of like a dimension or like 80 local things. But I think this says something about something about like what kinds of entanglement could be like efficiently preparable or so, something like that. I think it's worth studying. Just briefly, the future questions. So the two other interesting complexity classes that are absent from this list are StockMA and TIM. So these are problems that are related when we're not just asking for, is there a zero energy ground state, but what is the minimum energy ground state? So it could be that there is frustration that we have, not excited state, but the ground state is considerably above zero energy. And those states might be much more complicated. And with certain interactions, things are QMA complete. If you allow only particular forms, there's two natural complexity classes that are known, StockMA and TIM. So is this at all relevant? I don't know. I would really like to look for a way to actually try to make a classification to show that this maybe list of 7 classes is complete, that there's nothing missing. The classical proofs all revolve around the center of what are called polymorphisms of constraint problems. And I worked for quite a while to try to see if there was any analogous notion here of a quantum constraint polymorphism. And every natural definition I could come up with did not behave well. So I don't know if there's a good way to try to carry over those same ideas to build an analogous theory in the quantum setting. And it would be very nice to find a more physically reasonable construction for these classes to see, is there a really nice natural problem that captures this difficulty? All right, thank you.
Great. Thank you, Alex, for a nice talk. So at this point, we have 10 minutes or so for questions related to the talk. So please, if you have a question, just go ahead and raise your hand. Alex, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the talk. So just, I guess, two things sort of connecting back to the beginning of the talk. So one was you mentioned this very interesting CSP dichotomy theorem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I lost touch with, I guess in some sense, your results are towards or give some sort of quantum analog of that or are connected to a quantum version of that. And I sort of lost that connection.
Right. So I guess I just really, yeah, I guess I would like to work towards a quantum version of this. Okay. And
but you it's don't very... have that yet, I guess, to be clear.
Sorry?
You haven't shown that at this point.
I have not.
Yeah,
okay. I would like to, and I've tried to see if like any of the relevant ideas can be carried over, and it's pretty hard to prove that other things don't happen to build up an analogous theory. But the fact that it is so clean, and just these two cases in the classical case makes me sort of believe that there should be some like clean reasonable list in the quantum case as well.
And then could you say a little bit, maybe it's sort of technical, but the exact definition of a constraint satisfaction problem, it's just you have constraints on some like order one number of variables, and then, or yeah, I don't know. Can you say a little bit about what the definition is?
Yeah. So, so classically it'd be, I have a finite list of clauses. Each clause is a relationship on some finite number of variables. It's a relation. So like mathematically a relation so that, like certain configurations are certain sets are allowed and some are not. So, many problems people talk about might have just one clause, or maybe they have like three sets would technically be defined with eight different clauses. So,
I see.
For each like way of assigning the signs to the variables, I have a different clause, and that, you know, restricts what the variables are.
Right. And then each different CSP is defined by a different set of clauses.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So like three set would be one CSP, three coloring would be another. And as part of this, the definition of the CSP, you need to define the domain. So it's, you know, true and false or three colors, whatever it is.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Nirban, go ahead.
Sure. Hi, thanks for a nice talk. I was wondering, could you comment on the relation between your work and like work by Qubit and Montanaro on the classification of complexity for local Hamiltonian problems?
Right. So, so it's, their work is definitely like in a similar direction, trying to answer similar questions. And I believe that theirs is, I'm trying to remember exactly, but I think theirs is focused on they classify it up to like a certain locality. I think it's like two local or maybe three local or something like that. And but then they also go up beyond and they talk about the difficulty optimization as well. I think their work is two local qubits, but including like not just frustration problems.
I think it's really only for those types of max CSPs, like, because they always allow you to have weights. I think it does not, I mean, unless I'm not remembering some part of the paper.
I remember I looked at it, I don't want to try to Google right now, but I remember I looked at it and commented on it in the paper. There are some similarities, some differences. I don't remember exactly what they showed. But I think they restricted their locality more, but they did not. So they restricted their locality more. That, you know, restricts the scope, but they looked at these max sat things as well. So not just frustration free.
Second question. There's some works by, I think, Hans Bredel and Van der Nest and others on showing that evaluating partition functions for certain models can be BGP complete. Do you know if those can be used to show any kind of BGP completeness for local Hamiltonian problems? Or
I don't think I've seen that work actually, so I'll definitely check that out. I mean, I know that there are many interesting partition function problems that capture complexity classes in a nice way. I haven't seen the BGP complete. I'll definitely want to look at that.
Yeah. Yep. Thanks.
Maybe I could ask a question. So actually, I think if I remember correctly, the Montanaro qubit paper, when it came out, they motivated it by saying that it was like Schaefer's dichotomy theorem. And at that time, my recollection was that Schaefer's dichotomy theorem was this thing that you're stating here, but there must be a difference.
There is. There's the Schaefer's dichotomy theorem, and there's the what they call it. What I was talking about is the CSP dichotomy theorem, which is actually quite a bit harder to prove. The Schaefer's dichotomy theorem was proved in like the 70s. And there's also this like
but what's the difference in the setting? Like why?
Right. The Schaefer's dichotomy theorem is only for Boolean variables.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. But even then, I mean, I think that even at that time there was a kind of like criticism, or not criticism, but like it didn't seem to quite line up with the Schaefer dichotomy theorem, because it's not for constraint satisfaction, but rather for the maxsat version.
Right.
That I think was really a limitation of the technique that was used, which was the perturbative gadgets that kind of require you to have these weights. Right. Sorry, but I do actually have that wasn't actually the question I wanted to ask, but sure. I got down a rabbit hole. You had this this point about reducing to qubits at the price of locality. Mm-hmm. And I had a look at your paper, and there's some kind of gadget constructions, right? Like,
right.
So one question I have is, you know, when we talk about another problem in these constraint satisfaction problems is like reducing locality, you know, like going from 5 to 4 or 5 to 3, right? And mm-hmm. classically, that can be done using gadgets, and you kind of copy information and you know, but quantumly, we don't know how to do it using gadgets. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that, or does your version for reducing to qubits help you with this other issue? Or
sadly, not. I mean, yeah, it's in the end, it's this difficulty that you can't really copy the quantum data, right? It's not precisely, but it feels like a no cloning kind of thing. That's why it's difficulty to copy these things, and we can do it classically. Yeah. So there is this a sort of a gadget construction where you can use your just qubits, and it the idea is sort of that you spread your larger state across like several qubits, and then use some entanglement to like force them to group together, sort of analogous to like how those clock states had to be like linked together in a certain way. So like I force a certain set of qubits to act as one large qubit, it increases the locality at the price of shrinking the dimension, local dimension. I don't know how to improve locality stuff at all, unfortunately.
Thanks. Other questions about the talk?
Hi, Alex. Great talk. Question, you kind of mentioned offhand that you generalized some techniques on P completeness and ternary logic. So I'm wondering, do you mean P complete in the sense of like NC reductions, or this like positive completeness stuff, which there are, I did some Googling and found some papers about that with ternary logic, but curious which one.
I don't know what positive completeness is. I'm talking like log space kind of like P completeness.
You mean log space? Okay. Interesting. Yeah. What are these results then? I'm curious.
Well, I shouldn't say I generalize them. Like I use some of those ideas in building this BQP construction.
So, well, where do these ideas come from, I guess, is what I'm asking. I'm just curious.
Sure. So Hornsat is it's like a restricted version of 3SAT, where only one variable is allowed to be false in a given clause. It's a particular restricted form, and you can solve it efficiently by pretty much saying like you only have implications that go one way. If all these variables are true, then that one must also be true. If these are all true, that one must be true. Mm-hmm. And so you can sort of follow this implication chain, and that acts like a circuit propagating information along. Okay. Now, it only turns things that are true into things that are true. So what the standard like proof of P completeness uses what they call a dual rail logic. So now each bit in the original program now becomes two bits, one for was this bit true, one for was this false. Mm-hmm. And so either this one is true or that one is true. And so you can then have any circuit propagating these signals along. Is this one true or is that one true? And they send signals along. But this sort of allows a case where, well, what if both my wires are off? So in this dual real logic, so that's like an undefined state.
Oh, sure, that's right, yeah.
And so that's that, like, led me down after some thinking to this, like, way of, you know, how, what if we don't initialize things correctly? Because that's, in the end, that's why Hornstadt is still solvable. Mm-hmm. Why it's an NP hard. I can use this dual real logic and run any circuit, but if I have to set each input bit to either true or false, if I don't set either, then the wires are just off. It's undefined.
I see. So you have to, like, restrict to that subspace or that subset, or.
Yeah. So that with this additional undefined state that propagates trivially through your circuit, that way you know that everything will be really easy if you don't initialize. That's how you avoid the NP witness input.
Interesting.
And that was what, so for me, I just like had 0-1 and undefined as their own states on these logic, on the on logical qubits. And that way I was able to make sure that, the input can be uninitialized and it will still work.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great. So at this point, let's thank Alex.